It's Ideasphere with nuclear safety expert David Lockbaum. His book, Fukushima, the story of a nuclear disaster.
We're not giving our workers a reasonable shot to prevent the next Fukushima. If we kind of fix that, or shame on us if a disaster occurs.
The nuclear disaster in Japan 2011 should provide the United States with lessons learned. However, the jury is out. The carefully nurtured tale that technology will win out in the end may not be the full story. Hello, I'm Guy Rothman. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, with the director of the Union of Concerned Scientists, David Lockbaum. He and two of his colleagues, Edwin Lyman and Susan Q. Stranahan, have authored the book, Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster. And he joins me for this program. Mr. Lockbaum, thanks so much for taking this time.
Thank you, Guy.
You begin your work with reference to the Fukushima meltdown, in reference to what you say is the myth of society. You say nuclear power is an energy choice that gambles with disaster.
Yeah, we say that because the Fukushima plant had been operating for almost 40 years and was generally perceived to be of safe design, a safe regulator, a competent owner, and all the other things that would seem to be positive attributes. But in one day, in about an hour, all of those safety links in the chain were overwhelmed, leading to three reactor core meltdowns. So decades of perception of a very safe, almost invulnerable plant were eroded in very short order, fairly easily.
What about the fate of the Fukushima disaster? Because you say it also had direct ties to America's Nuclear Regulatory Commission and their fortunes in the nuclear industry.
Exactly. 9 months before Fukushima occurred, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a secret order to the owner of the Oconee Nuclear Power Plant in South Carolina. That secret order required the owner to take steps to better protect the plant should an upstream dam fail and flood the site. The NRC's analysis prior to that order had shown that that dam's failure would flood the site to about 14 feet of water, almost the exact same flood depth that the tsunami flooded Fukushima. The NRC's analysis also said should that occur, there would be a 100% chance that all three reactors melted down. Again, a very eerie precursor for Fukushima.
Well, that mirrors what happened at Fukushima with the exception of an additional reactor.
Yeah, the difference was that problem is still not fixed at Oconee, but its luck didn't run out. Right now, the people in South Carolina are being protected by luck, not by sufficient flood walls or other measures. It's luck. If that dam were to fail, they're toast. Fukushima had similar protections. It had a flood wall. It had emergency diesel generators. It had a bunch of barriers that looked good on paper, but didn't look real good on March 11, 2011. So that's what we refer to as the myth of safety. We anticipate things, but we put limits on our protection measures for those things because we just don't want to pay enough for them. But in hindsight, after Fukushima, the Japanese are paying far more than a few prudent safety measures would have taken before that disaster.
Well, then you follow up with the question, is this safety bad or economics bad?
Well, I think it's like which eye do you want to be poked in? You can make a good argument for either one, but the real answer is neither. You can do it right and therefore provide good safety and good economic results. In the book, we talk about the X plus one approach to safety. In Fukushima, they built a 15-foot tall flood wall but never ask themselves, what if a 16-foot tsunami wave arrives? They provided battery backups that would last for 8 hours, but never asked themselves, well, what if the power outage lasts longer than 8 hours? And so on. If had any one of those many barriers been more robust or had a valid contingency plan, we wouldn't have been known about Fukushima. That disaster could have been avoided very easily. But by providing limited barriers and never asking yourselves, what are the contingency plans? You're basically inviting disaster, and Fukushima reminds us that sometimes disaster accepts the invitation.
This jumps forward to a latter part of your work in which you say something I think that's going to surprise many readers, and that is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in outlining potential disasters, never look at the worst case scenario.
And it's also true in Japan. It's not a Nuclear Regulatory Commission exception. That's basically the same approach worldwide, is that you look for what you think the most likely disaster or hazard to occur over the next 40 years will be, and you design for that. That causes you sometimes to limit protection against earthquakes or protection against flooding or protection against fires or whatever the scenarios are, because the magnitude or the degree of hazard you're likely to have over those four decades is less than if you look at a little bit longer time frame out into the future. If you guess right, or if your luck never runs out, you look brilliant. If you guess wrong or your luck runs out, you're accused of having a bad safety culture.
And you don't sound very hopeful in your work that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and other organizations are going to make any significant improvements following Fukushima.
Well, I think there's mixed news on that. I mean, in some respects, the NRC does a pretty good job. Before Fukushima, the NRC found that the Fort Calhoun plant in Nebraska wasn't adequately protected against floods. Its owner said, "We've been here for 30 years. We've never had a problem, so the status quo must be okay." The NRC listened to those arguments and rejected them and made that plant fix its flood protection problems. In June of 2011, that plant became an island, literally, in the Missouri River that's flooded. And the NRC's efforts months earlier had served the public very well by having that plant protected against that hazard. So there are times that the NRC does the right thing. It gives us confidence that the NRC is capable of doing the right thing. What concerns us is it's not as consistent as it needs to be, and there's why we're relying on Congress or others to help the NRC protect all the people, not just the people in Nebraska or a few other places.
Well, sure. This goes right back to Fukushima in the respect that no one was expecting an earthquake of that size and magnitude in that area, followed by the tsunami. It was the tsunami that brought about the damage, which was totally unexpected. And in fact, the word was prior to that, that this plant can withstand those conditions.
Yes, the assumption was it could withstand those conditions individually. And that's true. Had it just been an earthquake or just been a tsunami, the disaster would have been averted. But the earthquake caused the tsunami, so they can't be decoupled in reality the way they were in cyberspace. At Diablo Canyon, the 1-2 punch wouldn't be an earthquake and a tsunami. It'd more likely be an earthquake that started a fire, because that plant doesn't meet the NRC's fire protection regulations. The fire damage would do the same bad things that the floodwaters did at Fukushima. They would take away primary safety systems and their backups, leaving the workers with literally no options for getting water from the ocean, which is right next door, into the reactor cores to provide sufficient cooling. So we have some similar vulnerabilities, and we need to have skill replace luck as the barriers against them.
Speaking of the Diablo Canyon plant, the readings for iodine-131 was much higher than thought possible, 5,400 miles away from the site of the Fukushima accident.
That's true. I think what you're seeing is that the computer models assume that radiation particles are uniformly distributed in the air or water and therefore get transported across the U.S. shores. In reality, there are particles that are not broken up even. It's not like sugar dissolving in water. It's more like particles that are suspended in water and also simply in the air. There are particles that are in the air that cause local hotspots or local high readings much higher than the overall plume, which assumes a more homogeneous or uniform mixing. The computer models are good, but they don't account for the hotspots that people sometimes detect.
In case you're just tuning in, talking about Fukushima and the accident of 2011, this book is titled Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster, authored by David Lockbaum, Edwin Lyman, and Susan Q. Stranahan, Union of Concerned Scientists, of which you're the director of the UCS Nuclear Safety Project. Mr. Lockbaum, do you have a website or anything else you'd recommend where folks can get more information?
We do. We have a website at ucsusa.org, and one of the features on that is you can do a search, is Nuclear Power Information Tracker, that allows people to see what problems affect the nuclear plants in their backyards or in their communities. We have about 7 or 8 issues that are currently bothering us and which plants are affected by those. Plus, just some general background, like which reactors are like those in Fukushima and so on.
And that includes the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, which has fallen under question, as you're talking about, with the potential for an earthquake starting a fire. There are other issues, too, in lead up to their licensing renewal proposal.
Yes, the plant applied for a 20-year extension to its operating license. That process is currently in abeyance right now as some issues or concerns identified with a earthquake fault called the shoreline fault that was identified in 2008 are further studied and understood. Once those answers come in or that homework is completed, then the company and the NRC will take up the issue of license renewal again and see whether 20 more years is acceptable or not. To be fair, more than 3/4 of the plants in the United States have already gone through and been renewed for 20 more years. It wouldn't be a surprise, or it wouldn't be untoward if Diablo Canyon were to receive that extension as well.
An interesting development that came out of Fukushima addressing the national issues for our nuclear industry in the United States, and that is the nuclear industry in Japan bypassed the NRC, essentially making them bystanders because they reached out directly to the industry itself.
That is correct on 2 scores. One, on the U.S. nuclear industry, they responded directly to its counterparts in Japan to help get resources to Fukushima quicker. There were some problems going through the normal channels. For example, the U.S. military airlifted a pumper truck to get water up into the spent fuel pools at Fukushima. They airlifted that pumper truck into a naval base in northern Japan. But local Japanese authorities wouldn't allow it to travel on Japanese roads because it wasn't licensed for Japanese service. So that truck sat on the tarmac there in the naval base for a while until that was worked out. The U.S. industry tried to act more directly to bypass some of those problems. The other side of the coin that predated Fukushima was the Japanese regulator is not as strong or is not as staffed as the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission is. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission employs almost 4,000 people, many technical experts, doctors, etc. The Japanese regulator had a much smaller staff and had to rely more on the industry for answering questions. It couldn't independently check the answers it got. It could not conduct as many inspections as NRC inspectors do. I mentioned earlier that NRC inspectors found problems at Fort Calhoun that caused flooding protection problems to be fixed. The Japanese regulator didn't have that similar process. It relied on plant owners self-identifying and self-correcting problems, which occurred, but not with the reliability that having NRC eyes at the site 24/7 provides.
Looking back at our own history of the nuclear industry and the largest disaster we have had to date is the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster and near meltdown. What grew out of that was the creation of the Nuclear Power Operations, the Institute, or INPO, as it's called. They were there as a clearinghouse for the industry. To what degree do you feel they have been effective in their work?
Well, I think INPO has been very effective at standardizing and improving operator training. Operator training issues were a factor in the Three Mile Island accident. INPO has established very high standards, which, for example, about every 5th or 6th week, operators go back into control room simulators or classrooms to update or refresh their training and awareness. The simulators provide hands-on experience, simulating disasters and so on, while the classroom training exercises upgrade them on new procedures or, for example, they'll be trained on Fukushima, what the lessons learned are, what the fixes are. And that continuing training has improved the performance at U.S. operating plants across the fleet. On the downside, we're a little bit concerned that sometimes INPO is a little bit late to intervene when performance levels are dropping. INPO was formed in 1980 after the Three Mile Island accident. Since that time, more than 4 dozen U.S. reactors have had to shut down for at least a year to fix safety problems. We're a little concerned that INPO should see those declines before it takes more than a year and an army of workers to fix them, because those long, protracted outages aren't serving safety well, and they're also not serving financial economics very well. So there's got to be a better way of doing this so we don't get that far off course.
There's also the danger of secrecy that seems to be rampant throughout the industry.
It is. I mean, Info is very secret. We've heard from their lawyers three times threatening to sue us for getting hold of Info documents. They're 0 for 3. We know how to do right. But balancing that, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's records, for the most part, are very publicly available. You can go on their website and see records dating back to 1999 for Diablo Canyon and every plant in the country. The only information that's really withheld from the American public deals with security inspections, which, you know, there's a good reason why that's not out in the public arena. So why it would be great if Info was a little bit more forthcoming. The safety net that the American public has is the NRC reports are very publicly available.
Looking at the latter portion of your book, Safety Measures, you say, are inadequate. That's the way it's titled. And you quote William Ostendorf, Commissioner NRC Ostendorf, as saying, "I personally do not believe that our existing regulatory framework is broken." And he adds, "Any policy changes needed to be done in consultation with our stakeholders." I'm out of that quote. Therefore, putting economics ahead of safety.
Yeah, we've already seen that in place. About a year ago, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff recommended to its commissioners, including Commissioner Ostendorf, that U.S. reactors be provided with a filter for anything that's vented from the containments, as was done at Fukushima, because that radioactivity can be very, very high and very, very lethal. The filters are relatively cheap, less than $10 million per site, and reduce the radiation levels by a factor of 1,000 or more. So it's a no-brainer. Yet the industry complained that they didn't want to spend $10 million, and the commission overruled its own staff. Every country on the planet except the United States and Spain have already taken that no-brainer step to better protect the public. But here in the United States, we can't even get the easy ones right.
In a technicality in reference to the NRC's research of Fukushima, they say it can't happen here. And you say technically they're correct.
Yeah, because none of our reactors are vulnerable to a 1-2 punch between a severe earthquake and the tsunami it generates. But other things, like the 1-2 punch of earthquake and fire, Diablo Canyon, flooding at Oconee, etc., can cause the Fukushima-style outcome disaster. What also bothers us about the NRC's position that it can't happen here is that 3 days before they made that proclamation, they ordered U.S. plant owners to take steps to better protect their plants from a Fukushima disaster. So if you truly believe that Fukushima can't happen here, why have you just ordered plant owners to implement safety upgrades to protect against the disaster you tell the public cannot occur? The problem is that they're more worried about PR than people's safety, and that forces them into those awkward situations where what they say doesn't really match what they do.
Well, this is going to that public relations PR reference you make. This is what came out of Japan. TEPCO, the owner of the Fukushima plant, was shown after studies the conclusion they made no significant errors. This is an interesting self-serving finding by a hand-picked committee. So there's your PR.
Yeah, that was an eye-opener. I mean, I understand they didn't want to fess up and say, well, look, every time we came to a crossroads, we made the wrong move or wrong decision. But to exonerate itself for the worst nuclear disaster in history is just a little bit cavalier.
How about the result of that? I remember reading that TEPCO was exonerated. Has there been any further reference, a study of the commission or anything resulting from that?
There hasn't been, and I don't think there will be, because one of the things that Japan has done as a result of Fukushima is significantly rewritten its regulations governing nuclear power safety, emergency planning, and so on. As a result, there's less interest in going back and see whether TEPCO violated some of the old regulations contributing to the disaster, and more the focus is going forward to make sure that nuclear plants, if they restart in Japan, meet the new regulations. I guess, except for the historian in me, that's really the right focus. Protect people tomorrow rather than indict people for yesterday.
Talking with the director of Union of Concerned Scientists, David Lochbaum, he's co-authored the book Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Mr. Lochbaum is in San Luis Obispo this evening at the Steinberg Gallery, 7 to 8:30. More information available at david@a4nr.org. Also, check out the Union of Concerned Scientists website, ucsusa.org. This is Ideasphere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with David Lockman, co-author of the book Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Well, it's been 35 years now since the Three Mile Island accident, and the study coming from one commission was that the safety status quo was inadequate, and in their views, how safe is safe enough? How do we reach that point of understanding the difference? It's not quite like driving a car too fast. There's a big difference in here.
Yeah, it is very difficult. In answering that question of how safe is safe enough, it's like beauty. Everybody has their own standard for what is safe enough. What we have defined safe enough to be is when plants comply with federal safety regulations. Because our safety regulations are developed through a public process that allows the public to intervene if we feel the bar is being set at too low a level. It also allows plant owners to intervene if they feel the safety bar setting being set too high, just driving costs up without any real safety benefit. But at the end of the day, those safety regulations, once adopted, they set the safety bar. What bothers us is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, after going through that process, then watches plant after plant limbo beneath that bar, like Diablo Canyon that doesn't meet the fire protection regulations. It has never met fire protection regulations over three decades of operation. It's not the only plant. There are 47 reactors, roughly half of the United States fleet, that don't meet the fire protection regulations. In 2008, the NRC senior managers testified to their commissioners that fire hazard represents about 50% of the risk of core damage at the typical nuclear power plant, which means it's equal to the risk from all other hazards combined. And that's if you assume the plants meet the regulations. If you don't meet the regulations, the risk goes up, not down. So the NRC has got to do something to enforce its regulations, not just spend a lot of time developing them.
Not only enforce them, but should they be the ones writing the rules? That's a risky situation you outline.
Well, I think it's because they do it through a public process that allows the public to intervene, or, for example, several groups, the state of New York, the National Resource Defense Council, and others, sued the NRC in court, saying that it's what it was doing about long-term spent fuel storage was inadequate. Those groups won, and the courts remanded the issue back to the NRC to fix the problem. So the public is provided an opportunity to weigh in, both easily with comments and then legally later if you're unsatisfied, and change in outcome. So I think our legal process is pretty good on that. It's not easy, but the public can prevail if there's an egregious outcome along the way.
One of the interesting quotes from your book is from a Princeton professor, Frank von Hippel, out of his book, Citizen Scientist, where you quote him as saying that calculations of probabilities were so uncertain as to be virtually meaningless. So if we take all this study of the safeties and potentials, we still don't have the answers, so we're grappling in the dark.
You know, unfortunately, that's true. One of the reasons for that is we don't have nuclear disasters every week, so there's not a lot of data to provide the statistics to do the analysis. So that's the good news. The bad news is we need to recognize that limitation and deal with it so we don't delude ourselves into thinking we're supermen, superplants. We recognize what the uncertainties are, we deal with them, and we don't wait for surprises like Fukushima to say, whoops, got a problem here. There can be surprises, but childlike wonderment is really best for Christmas morning, not at nuclear power plants.
Well, the new reactor designs are supposed to be much safer, at least that's the word we're getting, that we're moving into an arena now where our past is going to be benefiting the future by an improved reactor.
Yes, and one of the things we've asked is that the new reactor designs, if they're truly as safe as their proponents contend, they not be provided with federal liability insurance like our existing reactors are. Diablo Canyon and other plant owners don't go out and get private liability insurance against nuclear disaster. The federal government provides that. Well, if these reactors truly are safe, as their owners say, federal government doesn't need to be providing liability insurance. The fact that none of the owners will agree to that tells me that safety claims are more PR than science-based.
Well, yes, trying to work it both ways, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, the moment they start backing up their safety claims with their own liability insurance, then I'll remain silent and at least give them benefit of the doubt. But as long as they want my money to back up their claims, I'm going to remain skeptical.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, are they changing in their perspective of the potential for severe accidents? Do you see that on the horizon? Or are they merely pretending to feel that these accidents really can't occur?
I think they truly were woken up by Fukushima. I mean, it's hard to watch buildings blow up one after another and not realize that the status quo is dead. I think what concerns us is that the measures they're suggesting that be implemented at U.S. plants are well-intended, but they're not very reliable. For example, just a recent meeting at the NRC, the industry proposed to make some connections for portable pumps and portable generators to get water into the reactor core or the spent fuel pool, which is a big problem at Fukushima. But these connections are at locations that are inside buildings that if fuel damage has already occurred, workers can't go in there because it would be a suicide mission. So that somewhat limits their availability or their reliability. They can only be used to prevent fuel damage. They can't be used afterwards to mitigate how bad it gets. Likewise, they have no firm commitments for training. I'm here in Tennessee in the nuclear plant in my state, Watts Bar, installed hydrogen recombiners after the Three Mile Island accident to deal with hydrogen buildup that was also a problem at Fukushima. Well, a few years ago, they took that system out of service and removed it. But the emergency procedures that directed operators to deal with an accident told them to go flip on the hydrogen recombiners. Now, I don't know if the operators would have gotten their cars and driven around Tennessee looking for these things, or they would have come up with a plan B of their own and tried to figure out what they really should do. But there was no requirement for the NRC requirement for the owner to update its procedures to give the operators a good clue on what to do should that bad day arise. What Fukushima taught us or should have taught us was workers mean well. They'll try like heck to prevent bad outcomes, but you've got to give them a shot. You've got to give them a chance to succeed. By providing procedures that direct people to the wrong things, stuff like that, we're not giving our workers a reasonable shot to prevent the next Fukushima. We got to fix that, or shame on us if a disaster occurs.
Well, Mr. Lochbaum, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Guy, and I also appreciate you putting up with my voice, which is not normally as bad as it is today.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Dave Lochbaum will be at Steinberg Gallery this evening at 7 o'clock in San Luis Obispo. David at a4nr.org for more information. Fukushima, the story of a nuclear disaster. If you have any questions, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.